The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
If the nation's enemies pulled it off, Mack Bolan feared the United States would cease to exist as he knew it. He had walked this road many times in his war everlasting. Only this crisis defied any experience Bolan had ever known.
Are you Special Agent Matt Cooper?
That would be me. What do you have?
Major effing problem. If this thing blows up in our faces, the entire transportation network of the United States is shut down. End of story. Even if they set off one, two trains or buses, and you've got wreckage and dead bodies all over the highways and tracks, I don't even want to hazard a guess as to the chaos that would break out.
There's been a massive blast and derailment of the Coast Starlight train on the West Coast. This on the heels of the utter destruction of the Greyhound Terminal in Washington, D.C. Panicked citizens are asking, where is Homeland Security?
And while America seems besieged by enemies from without, was the real threat actually homegrown?
They call themselves Alpha Deep Six. They used to be Special Forces. Went underground about a decade ago, but now they've resurrected themselves. They're trying to be the masters of the global arms race.
You're telling me Alpha used what happened in this country today as a smokescreen? Why?
The terror funds.
What the hell? This is all about a bank heist?
Listen up, assholes. The hour of truth is upon us. Lazarus has risen. We are now officially into Operation Leviathan.
I am the Leviathan! Sprung from the bowels of hell!
And when Barbara Price is taken hostage, can Bolan conquer his personal hell and bring her back alive?
Where is the woman now, Turner?
I don't know. Thailand, Indonesia?
Go on.
What?
10 seconds, if you're a praying man.
I did. I prayed for money. It's walking out of here with you. Just do it.
Okay.
Get a hold of Mack Bolan number 100, Devil's Bargain, and take a trip to hell. But y'all come back now, yeah?
You do believe in the devil, don't you, Moody? You damn well better. You're looking at him.
Mack Bolan number 100, Devil's Bargain. Now available in Graphic Audio.
Come to Papa Great Satan!
All 4 packages retrieved. We're moving to primary extraction site.
Please repeat, Phoenix One. Did you say 4 packages?
A mission to recover stolen nukes turns into a race against time. 6 nukes?
Nuclear demolition charges, sir.
And the combined forces of Phoenix Force and Able Team. Are not enough to find them.
One more thing, Barb. Tell Akira his mission has been extended.
But the one man with the means to help them...
Very well. I will assist you.
...might also have the means to destroy Stony Man.
Akira! Carl!
Along with the Eastern Seaboard itself.
Herr Brognola, your team is magnificent. But it is over.
Stony Man number 86, Oceans of Fire.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Cry of Eagles. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by David Coyne, James Lewis, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Colleen Delaney, Michael Replogle, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Tim Carlin, and Christopher Graybill.
Falcon McAllister arrived in Tombstone after a long, hot ride across the desert. Though it was fall everywhere else, you couldn't tell it in Arizona. Falcon's face was sunburned and raw from his trip. He walked his big black stud Diablo down the dusty town street until he came to the livery stable. A pimply-faced boy appeared in the doorway of the barn.
Son, give him a good rub down and all the grain he wants. He's earned it. And don't put him too close to any of the other horses. He's kind of used to getting his own way.
Falcon saw the Oriental Saloon just down the street.
A drink would be just the thing to wash this desert sand out of my throat.
He figured to have a couple of drinks, get a hot meal somewhere, and see if this godforsaken town had any bathtubs in it. He'd been on the road for a couple of weeks straight. He was so ripe, even Diablo shied away when he got near him. Falcon stepped through the bat wings and hesitated for a moment, letting his eyes adjust to the gloom. It was an old habit, one that had kept him alive. The patrons noticed him standing there. Standing over 6 feet tall, he had shoulders so wide and muscular and a waist so thin that his suits had to be custom made. His eyes were a pale blue under short blonde hair. On the trail, he wore a dark shirt, denim jeans tucked into knee-high black leather boots, and a gray vest with a black silk handkerchief around his neck. On his hips were a brace of .44 Colts tied down low, and he carried an ace in the hole, a two-shot Derringer concealed in his boot. Once his eyes were accustomed to the low light, he surveyed the crowd. Nothing much to worry about. Several tables of punchers and cowboys in town to spend a week's pay, a couple of well-dressed Mexicans in for a night of horn, and a pair of star packers. From where he stood, Falcon couldn't read the badges. Probably town marshals or deputy sheriffs. They looked too young and green to be U.S. marshals. He straightened his hat and walked straight to the bar, leaning on one elbow and standing sideways, so as not to put his back to the room.
I'll take a whiskey with a side of water.
Yes, sir, right away.
Before the barkeep could fill it, Falcon put his hand over the top of the glass.
How about washing that before you put my whiskey in it?
No need to get ornery, mister. I just work here. I don't own the place.
The bourbon tasted good after weeks of nothing but coffee and water. The bite of the alcohol on his tongue and the warmth as it spread out from his stomach were mighty fine. As he stood there, taking an occasional sip of his drink, he reflected on where he was going to go after leaving Tombstone. Since his wife Marie had been killed, seeing new faces and locales every day kept his mind off what he'd lost. Occasionally, the cold sweats and rage would return, but the intervals between them were getting longer. Falcon snapped out of his reverie when he noticed the two star packers putting their heads together and whispering while looking in his direction. He wasn't wanted for anything, far as he knew. It didn't matter. Falcon knew that look. The hard, suspicious eyes, the tensing of the neck muscles as a man makes a decision whether to challenge a man. He'd seen it before.
Hey, you there, at the bar.
Yeah? What can I do for you?
What's your name, mister?
Falcon McAllister.
Two men rose and approached the bar.
You better come with us, McAllister. We got some wanted posters on you over to jail.
Gentlemen, if you'll look at the dates on those posters, you'll find they're over a year old. They've been recalled.
The younger deputy frowned, a puzzled look crossing his face. But the short, fat one's lips tightened and he stuck out his chin, his fingers twitching next to the handle of his pistol.
I don't recollect no recall notice, McAllister. I'm Deputy Stillwell. You better put them hands high.
Before you make the biggest mistake of your life, why don't you check with the sheriff or city marshal, deputy? I'm sure he'll remember the recall.
Nah, can't do that, fella. Sheriff Bean's gone out on posse. He left Jimmy and me here in charge till he gets back.
Falcon glanced at the other patrons of the saloon. Their confrontation had everyone's attention. Then Falcon saw someone he hadn't seen on entering. Over in a far corner, sitting by himself, a well-dressed man had a deck of cards spread out on the table in front of him in a game of solitaire. He had stopped playing and was staring at Falcon, an irreverent smirk on his face.
All right, boys. Let's go over to the sheriff's office and I can show you those recall notices.
We ain't going nowhere till you put them hands up, mister.
The short man went for his gun. In the flash of an eye, Falcon had both guns drawn and aimed before either of the two young men even cleared leather. They slowly raised their hands. Deputy Stillwell broke out in a sweat.
What are you gonna do with this, mister?
Damned if I know. I just came into town for a drink, a good meal, and a hot bath. I guess we can go over to the jail and try to prove to you I'm not a wanted man.
Falcon's eyes shifted as the man in the dark suit got up from his corner table and approached him.
Howdy, Mr. McAllister. My name's John Henry Holliday, but everybody calls me Doc.
Well, hello, Doc.
Falcon had heard of the infamous Doc Holliday, and he wondered why he was taking a hand in this matter.
Perhaps I may be of some assistance here. These boys are both dumb and cow fly, but they don't mean any harm.
Slow as they are on the jaw, they should find another means of employment.
I'm sure those thoughts are going through their minds even as we speak. But Deputy, if I take Mr. McAllister over to the city marshal's office and have Wyatt check him out, will that satisfy you boys?
Yes, sir, Doc.
That suits you, McAllister?
Sure. Anything, Doc, just so I get something to eat before too long.
Falcon holstered his guns.
Good. And right after we go see Wyatt and get this straightened out, I recommend Campbell and Hatch's Saloon. They got the best food in town, and the whiskey isn't half bad neither.
Hey, Doc, why don't you keep your nose out of other people's business?
He was dressed all in black from his hat to his boots, and he had the look of a gunfighter. Doc's face went flat and expressionless, and his eyes turned cold as ice.
You planning on upping the ante in this hand, Curly Bill?
Holliday pulled the lapels of his coat back to reveal a pistol hanging on his waist.
I might, Doc. Now you just give us time to go get our guns from the marshal's office, and we'll be glad to accommodate you.
Galliston, meet Curly Bill Brocious and Johnny Ringo. Two of the most butt-ugly men God ever put on the face of the earth. Well, go get your pistols and make your play, boys. And I'll put a tunnel in your skulls.
I've heard of you, Brocious, and you too, Ringo. And from what I've heard, you men usually don't face someone. You usually come at them from behind.
Ringo and Brocious' faces showed uncertainty. Before, they were two on one. Now the odds were even, and they'd seen how snake quick Falcon was with his guns. Doc addressed the other men at the table.
Ike, you and Billy want to join this dance? I never seen the Clanton brothers miss a good fight.
The two men sitting shook their heads and got up from the table and walked toward the bat wings.
Not right now, Holliday, but you'll be seeing us later.
Come on, boys. Now's not the time or place for this. There's too many people in here. You got plenty of time to deal with Holliday and Herb later.
Ringo and Brocious, with looks of relief, grabbed their hats off the table and walked out of the bar with the two Clanton brothers.
Nice quiet town you got here, Doc.
It has its moments.
How is it none of those men were armed?
When he became town marshal, Virgil Earp posted the town off limits to guns.
Falcon glanced at Doc's left hip, where he wore a pistol, but first for a cross and draw.
I'm something of a special case. Now, let's go meet Wyatt Earp and see about those recall notices so you can get some grub.
What was that all about?
The Clanton clan, Ike, Finn, Billy, and Newman, he's known as the old man, along with Frank and Tom McClary, Curly Bill Brocious, and Johnny Ringo, they call themselves the Cowboys. Did you notice those red sashes they were wearing around their waists? All the members of the Cowboys gang wear them. They're a bunch of local outlaws who had a pretty easy time of it around here until Wyatt Earp and his brothers Morgan and Virgil showed up.
What's that got to do with you? From what I've heard of you, you're not exactly a lawman.
I'm a friend of Wyatt's, though. I met him over in Fort Griffin, Texas a while back. We've been kind of running into each other off and on since then. The Clantons and McClory's know where I stand. They've been trying to get me out of the picture so Wyatt'll have one less gun back in his play.
Doc grabbed a soiled handkerchief out of his pocket and placed it against his face as he bent double. As he straightened up, Falcon could see streaks of crimson on the linen before Doc stuffed it in his pocket. He gave a sideways smirk at Falcon.
In my case, Tombstone may be a most appropriate moniker for this town.
As he walked along the dirt streets, Falcon could see the town was almost new. It had been founded only a few years before, on the basis of some rich silver strikes nearby. It was said the first settlers had to fight off Geronimo to stake their claims, thus leading to the name Tombstone. Most of the buildings were storefronts, with wooden facades in front and large canvas tents stretching out to form the main part of the building. Many of the lots between buildings had smaller tents staked out, with families living in some, and others serving as small stores, selling their goods out of the back of wagons. They walked into the city marshal's office and found a tall man dressed in a black coat, white shirt with a string tie, and gray trousers. He was loading a rifle.
Wyatt, I'd like you to meet Falcon McAllister, fastest man with a gun I ever seen.
That's so.
Wyatt stuck out his hand, and he and Falcon shook.
Yeah, Sheriff Bean's deputies, Stillwell and Jimmy, they braced him over at the Oriental Saloon. Said they'd seen sortie paper out on him a while back.
Are you wanted, Mr. McAllister?
Not anymore. A judge ruled my fight was self-defense and sent out recall notices about 6 months after the original posters were circulated.
Wyatt walked over to his desk and pulled a thick sheaf of papers out of the top drawer. After rummaging through them for a few minutes, he pulled one out of the stack.
You're right, Falcon. Here it is. You better keep that while you're in town. Sheriff Bean's deputies aren't known for their wits.
God damn, you're right about that. They'd probably have to get someone to read it to them if you pulled it out and stuck it in their faces.
Well, if you're done with me, Marshal, I'm mighty hungry.
By all means, Falcon. However, I'll have to ask you to leave your pistols here. There's a town ordinance against carrying weapons inside the city limits.
Okay, Marshal.
He unbuckled his gun belt and handed the brace of Colt to Wyatt.
Have a good stay in our town, Falcon. And if you're a gambling man, I deal the faro table over at the Oriental Saloon starting at 8 o'clock.
Faro is a game for men who don't understand numbers. I play poker, preferably stud.
Now here's a man after my own heart, Wyatt.
Thanks for taking a hand over there and for the advice on where to eat, Doc. I'll be seeing you.
As he walked down the boardwalk looking for the Campbell and Hatch Saloon, Falcon wondered if they had bass there, if he was going to have to check into a hotel to get clean. Suddenly, four men stepped out of an alleyway to block Falcon's path. It was the two Clantons and Ringo and Brocious, and they were spoiling for some trouble.
Hey, mister, we don't appreciate no strangers coming into our town and causing trouble.
He was a big man, about 5 feet 10 inches tall with a barrel chest.
Yeah? So why don't you just hightail it on out of here?
I don't want to.
We ain't exactly asking. We're telling you to leave.
Offhand, I don't see anyone big or mean enough to make me leave.
Clanton stepped out into the street and began to roll up his sleeves, revealing hairy, muscular forearms.
Oh, we'll see about that, mister. We'll just see.
Falcon took his hat off and hung it on the end of a hitching rail and walked slowly toward Clanton.
Are you sure you want to do this, Billy? I mean, I don't particularly want to spread your nose all over your face. It's already ugly enough.
The big man came running at Falcon, swinging his fist in a roundhouse punch. Falcon set his feet and didn't move, merely leaning his head slightly to the side so Clanton's blow shot harmlessly by his face. As Clanton twisted sideways from the force of his swing, Falcon threw a short left jab into his ribs. Clanton grabbed his side and bent over. Falcon swung from his heels with a right uppercut, catching Clanton flush on the bridge of his nose, flattening it. Blood and teeth were flying as Clanton's head snapped back and he staggered upright. He stood there in the middle of the street, swaying and shaking his head, trying to uncross his eyes, blood streaming from his ruined nose. He spat 2 teeth and ran at Falcon once more, his arms spread wide as if to catch him in a bear hug. Falcon bent under the arms and threw 2 quick jabs into Clanton's paunch, doubling him over. Falcon doubled up his fist and slammed it in the back of Clanton's head, knocking him flat on his face. He took the toe of his boot and rolled Clanton over, then turned to the 3 men remaining. Ringo pulled a long bowie knife out and began to walk toward Falcon, waving it back and forth, when Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday stepped up behind him. Wyatt clubbed Ringo in the side of the head with the butt of a sawed-off express gun, knocking the gunman to his knees and making him drop his blade.
All right, men, break it up.
He started it, Marshal. Why don't you arrest him?
Arrest him? Hell, I ought to pay him for the privilege of watching him beat the crap out of Billy Clanton.
Ringo shook his head and started to pick up his knife.
I wouldn't do that, Johnny, not unless you want your brains scattered all over the street like Billy's teeth.
I'll be seeing you, Earp. This ain't over yet.
You look right nice on your knees, Johnny. Perhaps you should spend more time there.
Ringo jumped to his feet, his hand unconsciously going for his empty holster.
You're twice lucky today, Johnny. First, Wyatt hit you in the head where it can't possibly do any harm. And then you face me with an empty holster.
Damn the both of you!
Ringo and Curly Bill Brocious lifted Clanton up by his arms and walked him off down the road. Falcon retrieved his hat from the hitching post and dusted it off.
Well, Doc, this is a right unhealthy town you got here.
Now don't be too critical, Falcon. After all, you haven't tried the food yet.
Would you care to join me for supper, Doc? It's the least I can do.
Why not? It'll be a change of pace for me, eating supper instead of drinking it.
After the meal at Campbell and Hatch's saloon, Falcon got his saddlebags from the livery and checked into the Grand Hotel. It was the finest hotel in Tombstone, and Falcon was finally able to get his bath. Afterward, dressed in his gambling duds, he walked out onto his balcony for a smoke. He stood there, breathing the crisp autumn air and looking up at the night sky. From the alleyway below his balcony, Falcon heard a familiar voice.
Hello, Frank. How's it going, Tom?
You boys all set for tomorrow night, Frank?
Yeah, you can count on the McClory's, Billy. Is Ike?
More than ready. We're sick of those Earp brothers sticking their noses in our business. So, the plan's set.
We'll meet at the OK Corral and get our extra guns out of our saddlebags, and then we'll hunt those bastards down and shoot them like the dogs they are.
It'll be easy, since they won't be expecting us to be carrying.
Now, Falcon usually made it a practice to mind his own business, but he liked and admired what the Earp brothers were trying to do in Tombstone. He decided it was time for him to play a few hands of Pharaoh. The Oriental Saloon was full to the brim with cowboys, miners, merchants, bar girls, and gamblers. Falcon threaded his way through the crowd to a corner table in the back, where he saw Doc Holliday playing poker with four other men. Doc didn't look good. His face had a fine sheen of sweat, and he was pale as a ghost. A large bottle of whiskey sat nearly empty on the table next to him, and a woman dressed in red satin sat on the arm of his chair, her arm around his shoulders. Falcon stepped up and tipped his hat at Doc.
My, 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 Mr. McAllister, but you certainly do clean up very nicely. I would like you to meet my special lady friend, Kate Elder. Kate, this is Falcon McAllister from Colorado.
Pleased to meet you, Miss Kate.
The girl was pretty in an overblown western sort of way. Her features were less than delicate, and she had a thin face with a large nose that was her most prominent feature. Her eyes were gentle, and it was evident from the way she looked at Doc that she worshipped him.
Doc, we've got to talk. Meet me at the faro table later.
Doc nodded, then returned to his poker game. Falcon noticed that even with the drinking, the pile of money and chips in front of Doc was sizable. Evidently, the man was a master card player. Falcon looked forward to playing with him. Falcon made his way to the faro table, smiling at Wyatt Earp, who was dealing cards from a lacquered box with a bright yellow tiger emblazoned on it. Bucking the Tiger, as Playing Against the House was called, was a game of high rewards if you could beat the tremendous odds against you. It was a game played by men who either didn't know the odds or were too drunk to care.
You ready to give the Tiger a go, Falcon?
Nope. I'm going to get a table. How about you joining me when you take a break?
That'll be just fine.
Falcon finally managed to find a small table against the wall that was unoccupied and settled in, sitting facing the crowd out of habit, even though he, along with everyone else in the room, was unarmed. After a while, Doc and Wyatt joined him at his table.
Wyatt, there's something you need to know. Billy Clinton, Frank, and Tom McClary are planning an armed ambush someplace called the OK Corral.
Wyatt sat there a moment, his face set and grim. Finally, he smiled.
Well, it was inevitable. It's time to put a stop to this feud once and for all.
Doc stood up and shook Falcon's hand.
Thanks for the information, Falcon. I'm much obliged to you.
What you gonna do, Wyatt?
Stick around until tomorrow afternoon and you'll see. So will the entire town.
October 21st was a clear, chilly day without a cloud in the sky. Wyatt, Virgil, Morgan, and Doc Holliday came out of the marshal's office. The four men walked abreast down the middle of the street, all dressed in long dusters. Doc put a shotgun under his coat, keeping it out of sight. Falcon was finishing lunch at Campbell and Hatch's saloon as they passed, and he saw him out the window. He threw a couple of banknotes on the table, grabbed his hat, and strolled outside. He stayed well behind the Earps and Doc Holliday, keeping to the boardwalk. He was curious to see how they would handle the threat. They turned left on 4th Street toward the OK Corral. Falcon stepped around the corner, and he could see Ike and Billy Clanton and Frank and Tom McClary out in front of the corral at the corner of 3rd and Fremont Streets, standing by their horses.
You boys surrender your weapons, or you're under arrest.
We don't want any trouble. Throw down your guns!
Billy Clanton and Frank McClary drew their guns, and Doc shot Billy through the chest. Then he turned his shotgun on Tom and put a double load of buckshot into his chest, killing him instantly. Ike began running down the street.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
Wyatt allowed him to pass. Suddenly, Frank shot at Doc, but the bullet hit his holster and ricocheted into his hip.
Damn it.
It was a minor wound. Doc whirled and fired his Colt, hitting Frank in the forehead. Billy, Frank, and Tom lay dead. Virgil had a bullet through his leg, and Morgan was wounded in both shoulders. Wyatt was the only one unscathed by the fusillade of bullets. In the aftermath, Falcon noticed movement out of the corner of his eye from the alley before him. Johnny Ringo was in the shadows, aiming a rifle at the Earps. Falcon pulled his derringer from his boot and stepped up behind Ringo, placing the double barrel against the back of his head.
I don't think I'd do that if I were you.
Ringo dropped the gun and raised his hands.
Now get on your horse and get out of town. There's been enough killing here today.
Ringo glanced back, hatred in his eyes, then sprinted down the alley toward his horse and jumped into the saddle. Ha! Ha! Falcon put his derringer back in his boot and went to help get the wounded Earps to a doctor. Doc pulled out a silver flask and calmly took a deep swig.
Much obliged for the help, McAllister. I myself may need special care, but only the kind Kate Elder can provide.
Tipping his hat, he walked off toward his room over the photography shop. Naiche, chief of the Chiricahua Apaches, watched the tiny settler's cabin from the mottled shade beneath a pine, resting his rifle atop the withers of his starving pony. Behind him, below the ridge, 10 warriors sat on their ponies awaiting his signal. Naiche was worried. He counted 4 white eyes moving about the cabin and barns near the spring, and if they had repeating rifles, an attack would be costly. Since leading their escape from Fort Thomas and the Indian Agency, he'd been careful to avoid army patrols and all other white men traveling in large numbers. Now the Arizona Territory was crawling with soldiers looking for Naiche's half-brother, sworn enemy of the White Star Chief. He was called Gokele, yet now most Apaches called him by his white man's name, Geronimo. He was dubbed that after the attack on a Mexican village on the day of the Feast of St. Jerome, Santo Geronimo in Spanish, when he began his war on all who settled traditional Apache lands in Mexico or the southwestern United States. Chocole rode her pony to a spot near the rump of Naiche's sorrel. She was a woman warrior, rare among the Apache, chosen for her bravery and marksmanship with a rifle.
Why do we wait, Naiche?
There are 4 of them. If they have rifles, the price for taking their food and livestock will come high.
Will we wait for the night?
I will watch them until the shadows come to hide our approach.
Naiche often doubted himself in the ways of war, for he was not like his brother, a master of illusion, who always caught his enemy by surprise. Naiche's thirst for blood made him reckless. He longed to hear the screams of the dying enemy. Waiting to enter a fight was hard for him.
As you wish, Naiche. I will tell the others.
The hard-twisted Apache cradled her rusted Spencer carbine in the crook of her arm. 2 Colt pistols were belted to her bony waist, and she bore battle scars from knife and bullet wounds. Naiche glanced at the sky. There would be no moon tonight, a sign from the 4 spirits that they approved of his attack on the cabin in darkness, hiding his warrior's approach. It was unwise to ignore a sign from the spirits, bad medicine that could cause their attack to fail and cost them many lives. With their ponies tethered in the ravine, Chocole led them toward the cabin on foot, then later on her hands and knees through tangles of creosote brush, until finally she went down on her belly to crawl, slithering like a snake under clumps of cactus and creosote stalks. Naiche crawled in her wake, while the others were scattered, forming a deadly circle around the log cabin with windows alight. Naiche noticed Toza and 2 more warriors move noiselessly off to his left. The circle was almost complete around the settler's cabin. Lamplight spilled out, framing the outline of a man with a rifle. It was too much for Naiche to resist. A perfect shot. He thumbed back the hammer on the Spencer. Chocole glanced over her shoulder, then she shook her head, asking him to wait until they were closer to the cabin. Naiche ignored her, his blood pounding through him. He sighted carefully along the barrel until he was certain he couldn't miss. The man in the doorframe dropped his rifle, clutching his belly. He staggered forward a half step. A second bullet ripped through his skull in a shower of blood, bone, and hair. Another figure dashed to the doorway with a rifle. Chocole was ready. The second white man let his rifle fall and reached for his throat, never firing a shot. Two more white eyes foolishly rushed outside directly into the line of fire. Coley rose up in a crouch to rush the door. Others joined in as Naiche began running behind Chakoli toward the cabin. He would enjoy torturing the survivors, especially the women. A boy less than 16 years old lay on the blood-soaked dirt floor of the cabin, holding a mortal wound in his side. Naiche stood over him, his knife poised above the white-eyed skull.
This is Apache land!
Blood sprayed from the torn scalp lock as Naiche held it high, showing it to Chakoli and the others. After the massacre, Chakoli joined Naiche outside.
All are dead. These white eyes are like all the others. Geronimo speaks truth when he tells us the white eyes have no stomach for fighting.
The other warriors began carrying flour and sugar and other foodstuffs outside to be loaded on the settlers' horses and mules.
The repeating guns are what make the white soldiers strong. When we raid the fort and take these guns for our own, the bluecoats will stand no chance. We must have Winchesters and many bullets, and more brave warriors who are not afraid to follow us. As we speak, Issa should be moving from one lodge to another, talking to warriors. Issa promises many will follow him.
Naiche watched Toza bring haltered mules and horses from the corrals behind the cabin.
Don't forget, Geronimo will return with warriors hiding in the Sierra Madres. He will steal many strong ponies, so our movements will be swift.
Drenched in blood, Otto came to the cabin door.
Let's eat the white man's beans. I am very hungry.
As soon as everything is lashed to the horses, we must be ready to escape quickly. When all is finished, then we eat. Chakoli and I will gather the guns and ammunition. One is a Winchester, a gift from the Great Spirit. With even one repeating rifle, we will kill many more of the enemy until Issa comes to the mountains.
Naiche turned toward the dark outlines of the dragoons high above the settlement.
Very soon, the land will be ours again!
The spirits have answered Geronimo's prayers.
It is not only his prayers the spirits hear. When Geronimo kills, the cries of his dying white enemies reach the moon, the wind, Mother Earth, and the sun. It is his courage the spirits reward, as well as our own, my warrior woman. We have only begun to fight.
Later, Naiche sat under the stars, admiring the Winchester rifle. With a box of cartridges by him, he kept watch from a ridge above the Chiricahua's hidden canyon, where the Wikiups of the women and children sat in an uneven line along the bare banks of a spring-fed stream high in the dragoons. Roasting a mule carcass on a fire pit below, several women attended to the cooking, turning it on a spit over a fire that gave off no telltale smoke. The spirits had indeed smiled on their raid. Chakoli walked softly up the ridge, balancing her Spencer in one hand.
The meat is almost ready. The rifle, do you know how to make it shoot?
I will teach you, but we must have many more, one for each warrior.
It will be a long war, even with rifles. The white eyes are like ants moving across the land.
More will join us.
Many are afraid, Naiche. The soldiers in their cages have broken their spirits.
It is true. Some of our bravest warriors no longer have the will to fight. They are dead in spirit, and only their weary bodies live on at the reservation.
Geronimo tells them this place called San Carlos is the worst. They dug a hole in the ground and covered it with logs, tossing scraps of food to him like a dog. I was with the Chiricahuas on Salt Creek when he was brought there in chains, covered in his own filth, starving. Blood dripping from where the chains cut into his flesh. But when he looked at me, I saw the same fire in his eyes. They could not break his spirit, and they could not break yours. You are a brave chief, Naiche,
I fight for my people, Chicole. More will join us soon. Until that time comes, we must continue to raid the White Eyes. When Issa comes with warriors and guns from Fort Thomas, we will be much stronger. Then, we will attack the larger ranches and white man's villages until we burn them all from the face of Earth Mother. The four spirits are smiling, Chicole. We have food and strong horses and mule meat, and the cattle will keep the children and women alive.
Naiche offered the Winchester rifle to Chicole.
I will show you how to load and fire it, but we have no bullets to waste. Once you understand how the bullets travel in and out of the barrel, and the way it must be loaded, it will be enough until we engage the enemy.
Will we fight again soon?
As soon as our warrior strength returns. Before the new moon comes, we will strike again near a ranch to the south. I have watched it for 2 days, and there are few White Eyes to guard it. I counted only 5. It is a town the white men call Tombstone.
Issa led 14 silent shadows among the barracks at Fort Thomas. Only 3, including Issa, carried knives, while the rest had no weapons. They crept to a corner of the building where rifles and ammunition were kept. Issa whispered to a young warrior beside him.
I will kill the guard on the left. You kill the one on the right, and be sure to cover his mouth so no one will hear him.
The warrior named Sola gave the sign for agreement. Issa readied his blade, inching forward. Sola came soundlessly behind. A shadow stirred on one side of the door. The gleam of a rifle barrel was dull, hard to see in dim starlight. Issa lunged into the soldier's chest, while Sola made a similar dive to reach the other guard.
What in the...
Issa jerked the blade upward and twisted the knife into the soldier's heart. He felt him grow slack, muscles quivering while more blood squirted from his mortal wound. Sola drove the second guard against the wall and pinned him there. Issa jerked his knife from the soldier's body and took the unfamiliar iron key from a ring attached to the guard's belt. As he had seen the soldiers do so often, he put the key into the lock and twisted it. The door opened into a dark room filled with rows of rifles.
Sola, tell the others to come quickly.
Issa hurried to a wall lined with repeating rifles. More shadows rushed into the armory. Each filled his arms with 4 rifles, while Issa took down boxes of cartridges and began stuffing them into burlap bags, 2 tied together so each warrior could carry a pair over his shoulder.
There are so many. We'll hide the ones we cannot use in the cave where Naiche waits for us.
Issa gave the fort compound a sweeping glance. It was late, and most soldiers would be asleep. It would be an easy thing to slip into the stables and kill the 2 who watched the barns. He moved back inside to finish loading the rifles and sacks of cartridges. Outside, Henry Peters was rolling a smoke, his rifle resting against the rear wall of the stable. He hated night guard duty. In the flare of his match, he saw a snarling face very close to his own.
Shit!
Suddenly, he felt a powerful blow to his stomach, followed by something ripping it. The pain was more than he could take, and his vision clouded. 15 mounted Apaches under the leadership of Issa rode quietly away from Fort Thomas, carrying more than 50 Winchester 44 caliber rifles and 300 cartons of shells. Issa led them south, riding back and forth in meaningless circles until the desert floor provided a slab of rock where the iron-shod cavalry horses would leave little sign.
It is good. Now we are ready for a war with the White Eyes.
Naiche will be pleased.
Word will reach Geronimo in Mexico. He will bring more warriors across the mountains.
I do not think so. He prefers to fight with only a few warriors, to strike quickly and disappear.
Heading toward the dragoons by starlight, Issa changed directions often to throw off pursuit. The next morning, Falcon entered the Oriental Saloon. He found Doc still sitting at his favorite table playing poker, looking like death. His pale skin stretched taut over his cheekbones, and sunken eyes held only the tiniest spark of life. He had been playing poker solidly for over 24 hours since the gunfight at the corral, taking only cigarettes and whiskey. Falcon could see the man was dying a little more every day. Perhaps that was why he refused to rest until he passed out, fear that the man with the scythe would come to him while he was sleeping. Falcon looked into Kate's eyes as she sat next to her man. The people in town called her Big Nose Kate, but Falcon saw only her devotion for Doc. She looked as if she had been crying, probably after trying to get him to eat or sleep, which made him angry with her.
Well, hey, Doc.
Hello and good morning, Mr. McAllister.
I'm fixing to head on down the road. You gonna let me leave town without buying you breakfast?
Doc's eyes narrowed even as his lips curled in his ever-present sarcastic grin, as if he knew what Falcon was trying to do.
Well, I would never be so rude, Falcon. Just give me a few more minutes to finish teaching these young men the rudiments of poker, and I shall join you at Campbell and Hatch's.
Campbell and Hatch's saloon was a combination bar, dance hall, billiard parlor, and eating establishment. It was equally busy around the clock. The crowd consisted mostly of businessmen getting a bite to eat prior to opening their doors, red-eyed cowboys trying to get some coffee into them, and a few dance hall women taking a break. Falcon grabbed a table and sat facing the room. Doc walked in a few moments later, and Falcon noticed he was limping slightly from the bullet wound in his right hip. He could still see the bullet hole in his pants and the blood stains on the cloth. Evidently, Doc hadn't even changed clothes before he began his marathon poker match. Doc took a seat next to Falcon, so he too could watch the other men in the bar. When the waiter brought them cups of coffee, Doc took out a silver flask and poured a dollop of amber liquid into them.
A toast to the man behind the scenes.
Now what do you mean?
Don't think you went unobserved in your little altercation with Johnny Ringo. Your timely interference was much appreciated. The man might have gotten lucky and actually shot one of us.
These last few years, there had not been many men he enjoyed being with. Billy the Kid had been one, and by God, Doc Holliday was another. The man's sense of humor and his loyalty to his friends made Falcon feel a kinship that was rare for one who spent most of his time alone. The waiter arrived with plates of scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, tortillas, sliced tomatoes and potatoes.
What are you going to do now, Falcon?
Mosey on down the trail, I guess. I've still got a lot of country to see.
Well, now why not stay here in Tombstone? It is a growing town. And given enough time, I might even be able to teach you how to play poker.
That'll be the day. In the little time I've watched you, I've noticed you have a tendency to go against the odds. In the long run, that's a no-win strategy.
Ah, but that is the key, my friend. You see, for me, there is no long run, only the end now.
Doc bent his head and began to nibble at his food. Falcon could tell his heart wasn't in it. He knew consumption took away the appetite.
I believe after this fine repast, I shall take my rest.
Good idea. I think I'll pay the Earps a visit myself.
Wyatt Earp answered the door, a pistol in his hand.
Oh, it's you, Falcon. Come on in.
Morgan was lying on a sofa, propped up on several pillows, bandages on both shoulders. Virgil was across the room with his wounded leg stuck out in front of him on an ottoman, a shotgun cradled in his arms.
Expecting trouble?
Yeah. Sheriff Bean has been making noises about arresting us for murder.
But he has no authority in Tombstone. He's a county sheriff.
That's correct, Falcon. But he still has plans to haul us in to stand trial.
How do you think it'll play?
There's no telling. Half the people in Tombstone make a lot of money off the cowboys' trade. They're gonna be plenty pissed off that we've shut them down.
Well, I just came to say goodbye and good luck. But if you need some help...
No, Falcon, you've done enough. This is our battle now. We'll see it through.
I'll keep watching the newspaper. If the trial starts going against you, I'll be back.
Thanks, Falcon. Vaya con Dios, partner.
Falcon rode Diablo out of town. As he reached the southeast city limits, he saw three men on horseback, followed by two buckboards coming.
Hold on there! Hold!
As he pulled abreast of the wagons, he glanced inside, and his stomach went cold. There were several bodies laid out in a row. All had been scalped.
What happened here?
We found these poor folk up at the cabin in the foothills of the Dragoon Mountains. Looks like the Apaches got them.
Falcon dismounted to take a closer look. His heart ached at the sight. There were two women, their bodies covered with blood-soaked blankets. The noonday sun glinted off one's bare skull where the scalp had been hacked off. Her face, even in death, still wore a look of horror. Falcon gently closed her eyes with his fingers. Then his fist clenched as he felt the familiar killing rage sweep through his body.
Some soldiers came by our claim the other day and said Naiche and a band of followers was on the warpath. But the Bluebellies was having trouble locating them.
I've heard of them. Some people call them the Human Tiger.
Yep. Yeah, they also said another band about 20 or so Injuns escaped from Fort Thomas last week with Winchester repeating rifles and a whole shitload of ammunition. I plan on staying in town for a while to give these soldiers a chance to catch them. They ain't bad enough with bows and arrows, but they're gonna be plumb hell with repeating rifles in their hands. They took off with some horses and mules, too. Yeah, there wasn't much of that cabin that hadn't been torn to pieces.
Those sons of bitches. How do I find this cabin?
Now you take the North Fork up the road heading into the Dragoons about 3 miles up, and you can't miss it. But, mister, I gotta tell you, you're crazy if you go up there.
Falcon climbed into the saddle and rode off, his back stiff and his neck thick with anger. He'd be damned if he was gonna let this happen to anyone else. Not if he had any say in the matter. On the trail up into the mountains, Falcon tried to calm himself down. He knew he was traveling in dangerous territory, and he needed a clear head. It was a strange fact, but true, that the surest way to get killed in a battle was to be angry. The mind had to be calm, or the body would die. He took a deep breath of the cool, crisp autumn air, glancing around at the mountain forest he was heading into. The pinyon trees were a deep emerald, while some other trees Falcon didn't recognize had already started to change their leaves into brilliant patterns of gold and scarlet. After a while, he felt better. His heart had slowed to its normal beat, and his mind was focused. As he neared the spot where the cabin was supposed to be located, he began to search the trail and surrounding brush for Indian signs. Finally, he came to a small clearing in the trees off to the side of the trail. He could see a wooden cabin about 50 yards into the forest, with a cleared area around it containing a couple of corrals and outbuildings. He eased out of the saddle and pulled his Colt, holding it ready. There was a chance the Indians might have come back, and the smell of blood could have drawn wolves or bear. In any case, it was wise to be prepared for anything. In front of the cabin door, he found blood soaked into the already reddish dirt, making it a deep crimson, almost black. From the way the ground was torn up, he saw they hadn't died easy. He slipped in the open door of the cabin, standing with his back against the wall until his vision adjusted to the gloom. His stomach churned at the smell of dried blood, excrement, and seared flesh that still hung in the air. Bodily fluid stains were splattered on walls and floors. The place was a slaughterhouse. As he walked through the tiny room, he found two dresses, one adult and one child size. They'd been torn off the females. In the corner against the far wall was a reddish clump of meat. He realized it was a human liver. He searched the rest of the cabin, finding nothing of interest except that the cabinets were emptied and a gun rack nailed to the wall was bare. Falcon whirled, bringing his pistol up.
Don't move!
A man stood in the doorway.
Hold on there, Sonny Jim.
He was dressed in buckskins with moccasins on his feet, a bushy beard, and he held a Sharps 50 caliber rifle pointed at Falcon.
Just what are you doing in this here cabin?
I'm looking around.
What say we both put these guns up and palaver for a spell?
All right. But outside, if you don't mind. I need some fresh air.
It is a bit ripe in here, ain't it?
Outside, Falcon tried to clear the stink of death from his lungs. The man in buckskin walked to a fallen tree on the edge of the forest and sat, resting his sharps on his lap. Falcon sat down next to him.
My name's John Henry Hawkins. Most folks just calls me Hawk.
I'm Falcon McAllister.
What's your interest in this cabin, Falcon?
My wife was killed by renegades a while back. I don't intend to let this massacre go unanswered.
One of the men killed here was my baby brother. I sent word to him a few months back and told him how much silver was to be had out here in the Dragoons. Damn fool brought his wife and daughter and two other pilgrims with him from back east. I tried to tell him to leave the womenfolk in town and let me teach him something about living out here in the wilderness where they try to settle in, but they wouldn't listen. This is mighty pretty land, but it's wild. Ain't no place for pilgrims and women.
How long you been mining out here, Hawk?
For about a year. I scouted for the army a spell and then tried my hand at hunting buffalo. When the buffalo got scarce, I heard about the silver strike near Tombstone and just kind of drifted this way. God knows I wished I'd never come here.
What's your plans now?
I plan to hunt down the murdering bastards that did this and do to them what they did to my kin. I ain't gonna rest till my horses carrying they scalps.
Falcon glanced at the cabin and the dark stains in front of it. He got up and walked to the place where the dirt was soggy with blood. Squatting, he dipped his finger in the soil and rubbed a horizontal crimson streak across each of his cheeks like war paint.
You want some company?
Hawk pulled out his knife and stuck the point into his thumb. When blood welled up, he wiped his thumb across his cheeks as Falcon had, then stuck out his hand.
To the death.
To the death.
Let's get moving, partner. We're burning daylight and I got me some Injuns to kill.
After sealing their agreement, Falcon took a weathered set of buckskins out of his saddlebags and changed into them.
These are my going-to-war clothes.
Along with buckskin trousers, shirt, and Apache-style moccasins that rose to his knees, Falcon added a brace of Colt 44 caliber pistols and his long, thin knife and Arkansas toothpick to his belt. He loosened his Winchester 44-40 carbine and a rifle boot on the right side of his saddle, and tied a standard 10-gauge sawed-off double-barrel shotgun to the pommel, where it would be within easy reach should they be attacked. Hawk stepped up to his horse, a buckskin, tan with black mane and tail. He took from his saddlebags a belt and a single holster carrying an old Colt Army 44 and strapped it on, then stuck an extra pistol in the left side of his belt, butt first for a cross-hand draw. He pulled a small canvas bag full of shells for his sharps and attached it to his belt next to the scabbard for his bowie knife. While he swung into the saddle, Falcon studied the tracks that led away from the cabin into the woods.
I'm making about 10 or 11 Indians, leading another 5 or 6 horses and mules. The Indians are all riding shod horses, so they must be stolen.
Injuns never have figured out how to remove horseshoes. It'll make it easier to track them. The shoes leave marks on hard-packed ground and rock.
Since you used to be a scout for the army, you won't lead the way?
Hey, don't mind if I do. Might be a bit rusty, though. I hadn't done this for a lot of years, partner.
Hawk led the way into the forest. The Indians had not taken the trail, but ridden straight up the side of the mountain through scattered cacti and creosote bushes. They progressed only about 150 yards. Hawk's horse suddenly reared up on his hind legs, almost throwing Hawk to the ground.
Oh, what the hell?
Falcon filled his fists with iron and rode up beside the man, fearing an attack. He slowly holstered his gun as he followed Hawk's gaze. One of the settlers' heads was impaled on a spear, facing the Indian's back trail with a leering stare. The eyes were black with flies.
Damn, I ain't never seen nothing like that.
I heard that the soldiers over at Fort Grant, a prison fort for Apaches and other lawbreakers in Arizona Territory, once did that to an Indian as an example not to try and escape.
You think maybe the ones that done this is from Fort Grant?
Could be. but it just might be their way of warning anyone who tries to trail them what's waiting for them up ahead.
Falcon took the head and buried it in the soft sandy loam of the mountainside. As he walked back to the horses, Falcon picked up the spear, which he had cleaned, and stuck it under his saddle skirts alongside Diablo's flank.
What do you want with that old spear?
The same thing the Indians used it for. We're going up against at least 10 warriors who've already proven they're killers. I've heard there's another 15 or 20 headed this way who may join up with them. The only chance we have is to spread a little fear into the men we're hunting, perhaps make them careless. That means we've got to be every bit as ruthless as they are. And this spear is going to let them know that we're on their trail, and we'll give them no quarter. Let's go.